Hey, good morning. I'd like to welcome all of you to the Agricultural and Applied Economics Association Extension Section and Ag in Uncertain Times Team for Western Extension Committee's webinar this morning. This webinar is presentation intended to assist agricultural professionals to meet the challenges in today's agriculture. The webinar title for this morning is an important one. It is Managing Drought and Disaster Impacts. This drought and natural disasters have caused widespread challenges across the entire farm economy this past year, increasing price volatility and production risks, as well as increasing financial uncertainty. So we thought it was an especially important topic at this point in time. I'm George Haynes. I'm the Extension Economist at Montana State University, and I'll be your moderator this morning. We have three excellent presentations today, actually handled by four individuals, Erica Rosasenko and Caitlin McCulloch from Livestock Market Information Center. We'll be doing the first presentation today. The second one on production agriculture by Dr. Rachel Endicott from here at Montana State University. And the final presentation by Jeff Trunell from Colorado State University. Now, just to make sure that everything is working okay with your system this morning, we do have a Q&A box that's set up for you. So if you have any questions that you'd like to ask us, please type them in the Q&A box. And when you're done typing, be sure and click the button over on the right-hand side of that box so that we have a chance to look at those questions for you, and we'll be try to answer as many of them, or at least pose as many questions as we can during the hour and a half that we're on today. In addition, for those of you that would like to have a little bit larger viewing area on your screen, there is a full screen button up in the upper right-hand side, and if you click on that, you'll be able to see a larger size presentation. And you should still be able to see the Q&A window as well. So if you want to type in some questions, you'll still have access to that. So a couple technical details here that are important. Now, we'll start off this morning. We have a few polling questions that will appear on the screen here momentarily. So the first of those, please tell us about yourself and what's your primary occupation. We'll give you about another 5 seconds or thereabouts to answer this polling question. Okay, the second of these questions, so we can have a profile of the people that are listening today, is what's your main place of business located, or where is your main place of business located? Okay, thirdly, are you currently a member of AAEA Extension Section? Okay. Okay, number four, including yourself, how many individuals are participating in this webinar from your home or office? The first presentation this morning is by Erica Rosasenko and Caitlin McCulloch from LMIC, entitled Cattle, Dairy, and Feed Market Outlook. Erica will start off this morning. Erica is an agricultural economist with LMIC since 2002. She received her agricultural economics degrees from University of California, Davis, and Purdue University. Erica is a nationally recognized market analyst and the lead analyst for the LMIC for sheep and hogs. With that, Erica, you're on.
Great. Thank you again for having both Caitlin and I today. I'll be talking a little bit about the cattle market. We have a lot to cover in a short period of time, so I'll probably move fairly quickly. As we know with the cattle and market, the drought, 2 years of drought, dramatic impact on the cattle industry, particularly on the cow-calf sector and the feeding side. Today I'll be focusing mostly on the cow-calf sector since this is mainly directed towards the western and midwestern regions of the U.S. Overall, the drought devastated pasture and range conditions in the Midwest. I mean, it was just horrible when we talk about the crop conditions. As a result, we saw skyrocketing feedstuff prices. Caitlin will talk a little bit more on the forage side as we move through this morning. But overall, cow-calf returns just suffered as the drought continued this past year. So we move on. Overall, pasture and range conditions, unlike last year, they deteriorated across the U.S. As a result, we did see further herd liquidation in 2012. beef slaughter, when we look at the rate of change relative to the January 1 inventory number, it does suggest that we are going to see a decline in the U.S. cattle herd, the number of beef cows, come January 1. In addition, the drought situation and the impact it had on cow-calf producers, we are going to see the number of heifers retained, again, be very modest to very disappointing based on when we've had these conversations and outlook meetings in prior years. Overall, we are looking at a tighter feeder cattle supply as we go into 2013 and 14. Of note, if drought conditions do persist into next year, it will provoke more beef cow herd liquidation and further delay any retention of replacement heifers. And overall, we're going to see herd growth continue to decline and basically be put off for another few years until we're back into what we consider more of a normal conditions in terms of pasture and range and feedstuff prices and overall cow-calf profitability. So as I mentioned that, the LMIC, currently we have forecasted out and our estimates for the January 1 inventory number that will be released by USDA National Ag Statistics Service at the end of January. As you can see, we forecast numbers going up and going down. Unfortunately, with 2 years of drought, we are looking at the January 1 inventory being down. This past year, January 1, USDA reported the number of beef cows were at 29.9 million head. That was about a 3% drop from 2011. As we go into 2013, we're estimating here at the LMIC that that will come in for the number of beef cows, the beef cow herd on a national basis, at 29.4 million head. That's about a 1.5% to 2% drop. We're looking at that 475,000 to 500,000 head range on the beef cows. The rate of change is moderating compared to prior years, but it is still moving down that lower forecasting range as we look ahead. Overall, if we're talking total U.S. cattle and calf numbers, our current estimates here at the LMIC are down about 2%. A lot of our estimates have been based on what happened in the fourth quarter in terms of beef cow slaughter. There has been some confusion, and I'll just take a side note about beef cow slaughter being down from prior year and that the cow herd is not declining, but you need to look at the rates of change. And so with the beef cow slaughter numbers relative to the January 1 inventory, that rate of change would suggest we are going to see a below year-ago number come January 1 of beef cows and total cattle and calves. As I mentioned, as a result, we are going to see feeder cattle supplies be very tight. We're looking at a calf crop, again, probably being the lowest since the 1940s. The tight supply situation will be supportive to calf and yearling prices as we look ahead, but the problem is this past year, feeders have had very significant financial losses. As we could say, they're bleeding red ink. So overall, as we look and talk and going into 2013, particularly the first half, those calf prices, those yearling prices, are probably not going to see the same levels that we saw in 2012 until those feeders can improve their financial status and try to get back in the black. We also expect, even though tight feeder cattle supplies, if we do get normal range and pasture conditions, we do expect feeders to continue on trend, placing heavier weight feeder cattle, trying to reduce the number of days on feed to try to get back into the black and improve their profitability on the feeding side. So in one way, tight feeder cattle supplies will be supportive to calf and yearling prices, but it'll take some time given the significant losses in the feeding side. Overall, basically, the events of the last 2 years, the drought in the Southern Plains, and then this past drought this year coast to coast, overall, we're set up for a decline in beef supplies in 2012 and looking ahead. These are our quarterly forecasts. Here at the LMIC, we forecast out about 16 months, so we have both 2013 and 14. 2012, we are forecasting beef supplies, total beef production to be down about 1%. We did see larger year-over-year increases in cattle weights this year than earlier forecasts, so that did help out a little bit when we saw a significant decline in the number of fed cattle available for slaughter. As we go into 2013, the impacts of the drought are clearly seen in this chart. We're looking at beef production being down over 4% and even more significant as we move into 2014, down 5%. We aren't expecting much year-over-year gains in cattle weights because of the losses in the feeding side and the impacts we've seen on the feed costs and the available supplies of feed at this point in time. Overall, beef prices will be relatively high. They're going to forecast to be record high. We're talking on the retail side into 2013-14. In fact, all proteins will be record high. However, beef relative to pork and poultry will be extremely expensive, and that will limit how far wholesale beef prices can move. And as well, that will trickle down into fed cattle prices and feeder cattle prices. but still the outlook is positive, but that is a limiting factor to keep in mind. So talking about prices, our forecast as we see our prices going to 2014, calf and yearling prices this year were very volatile. The drought basically crushed calf prices this summer. The redding flowing on feeder, on the feeding side, they just couldn't pay very high prices for feeder cattle, as we well know. The feed costs, the high break-evens going into next year, that's still putting in some volatility into calf and yearling prices and limiting how high they can go. And overall, what we're looking at as we go into for the year for 2012 on an annual basis, we do expect calf, yearling, and fed steer prices to average above a year ago. But the calf and yearling prices are under a lot of volatility, and as I mentioned earlier, going into the 2013, those calf and yearling prices aren't going to move up much. Any year-to-year increase from the support of the tight supply situation of feeder cattle is going to come during the second half of 2013, when the feeding side can regain some of your losses and get back in the black. Talking a little bit on the fed side and overall slaughter cow side, those prices we expect to be fairly seasonal and not go through as much volatility as we expect to see on the calf and the yearling side. Overall, you can clearly see it is a positive outlook. 2013 and 14 on an annual basis, we are looking at calf, yearling, and fed cattle prices to post significant year-to-year increases with record prices looking ahead as we move forward. The problem comes on the cost side and what's going to happen, pasture and range, feedstuff prices, and I'm going to leave that up to Caitlin to discuss more of that. So as we move through, overall, cow-calf returns really took a hit this year. Earlier in the year when we pre-drought, shall we say, coming off of the Southern Plains drought and moving into what we thought was going to be a wonderful summer in terms of pasture and range and overall crop conditions, here at the LMIC, we were forecasting returns to cow-calf returns about $180 per cow. As the summer unfolded, the drought continued to intense. Crop prices continued to rise as crop conditions deteriorated. We saw about $125 loss in cow-calf return. So at this point in time for 2012, LMIC is forecasting about a $57 per cow on cow-calf return. So our estimated average cow-calf returns on a per cow basis is about $57 compared to $180 at the onset of 2012. That's a big loss, and that's mainly due to this drought situation in terms of pasture and range, the volatility in calf and yearling prices, and also the feedstuff prices. So in essence, if we look back at 2012, the drought basically eliminated any economic ability and incentive for cow-calf producers to expand or even consider expanding or retaining heifers. And the concern is if these conditions do continue, we are just going to continue delaying seeing any growth in the cow herd. So to summarize, because I know we have a lot to talk about and this morning, here's a few points that I've mentioned. Price volatility will continue, just not because of the feeding side in terms of calf prices, but overall the international markets and things of that sort. Market shocks, we do expect those to continue. We do not really operate in a normal market. I don't know when we've had a normal market, I'd say in the last 5 years. Economic incentive to stabilize and rebuild. Cow herd was basically eliminated with the drought. If we do see drought conditions improve next year, if we get back to maybe better conditions, what we may consider a normal year in terms of that, we could see some herd stabilization and see some more growth and overall replacement of heifers going back in the cattle herd. Overall, the factors have been in place for reduced beef supplies the last 2 years, and it's further basically set up for the next 2 years. We're going into a tight feeder cattle and a tight overall beef supply situation. High feedstuff price range is expected to continue, and again, Caitlin will go more into that. The red ink right now that the cattle feeding side is experiencing the significant financial loss is really what's limiting calf and yearling prices from posting significant year-to-year increases, as what the supply side would suggest that prices should move. Overall, from a cow-calf standpoint, when you're looking at your risk management plan, your overall production management plan, mistakes can be costly, and basically overall sound business practices required, and probably more being current on your practices instead of maybe the once a year or once a quarter. You may need to be looking at that and being more on top of that week to week, month to month, being on top of the market and the industry. Overall, agile firms will benefit. Be adaptable and not adapted. You need to keep adapting to the market, and that's what I mentioned maybe when you review your risk management and your management production plans, it needs to be more on a timely basis. So with that, trying to keep on time, I'm going to turn it over to Caitlin to give us a little bit on the dairy side and the forage side.
Okay, thanks a lot, Erica. Our second presenter from LMIC is Caitlin McCulloch. Caitlin's an agricultural economist at LMIC. She joined LMIC to establish her dairy economist position after completing degrees in Ag Econ and Ag Business at Colorado State. With that, Caitlin, nice to have you with us today, and the webinar is yours.
All right, thank you for having me. All right, so let's get started with the dairy market outlook and talk a little bit about 2012. 2012 was a unique year. Milk production had very, very high gains in the first half of the year. This was largely because of a very mild winter, but we also had one extra day in leap year. However, with the drought starting to pick up in the summer, we saw record high temperatures affecting cow comfort. The drought also made feed costs record high, which led to some producers cutting the quality of feed, which also impacted milk per cow, and as a result, total milk production slipped below a year ago towards the summer months and continuing now into the fall. One of the other factors affecting total milk production was a declining cow herd, and this has been driven by very low margins this year. Because of the excess supply produced in the first half of the, or the first quarter of the year, milk prices started to decline into summer, and then they finally bottomed in the summer of in July 2012. Now, this has also continued today. Cow slaughter has been up since July year over year, and we've seen a steady slip in the number of cows. Since the summer, however, some prices have climbed rapidly, and this has been mostly supported by the cheese market, and consequently, Class 3 has risen since then, and that's largely been supporting the all milk price since summer. The cheese price is thought to be largely supported by the export market. Across the complex, dairy has had pretty steady gains year over year, however, not nearly as strong as they have been in the past. However, cheese has remained a very consistent growth market for this year. Now, in spite of prices being higher, margins are still very tight for dairy producers. 2012 had some of the lowest milk-feed ratios on record, and they've actually been worse since 2009, and we'll talk a little bit more about feed costs in the next presentation. Now, it's because of low margins that we've really seen this dairy cow slaughter pick up, especially since July. Cow slaughter has been well above a year ago for most of the year, and this will likely continue through the remainder of this year and also into next year. And this is largely going to define some of our forecasts that I'll show you in a minute. So the key drivers moving forward is going to continue to be the export market. We've come to kind of rely on them to pick up some of that excess milk supply, and we saw in the first half of the year that they didn't really take as much as they normally do. The growth rate has slowed in a lot of the export markets, and so it's something we need to watch out for, because oversupply can be an issue if we have very high gains again. Cow herd liquidation, as I said, is going to really define our forecast. This is largely driven by profitability and feed costs. Most of our forecasts really hinge on this cow herd liquidation and getting producers back to a profitable level. One of the things I didn't include on this slide is the farm bill. Our forecast reflects the status quo, but that could definitely have an impact in the future, depending on when it gets passed and what the end result is. So in terms of forecasts, as you can see, this reduction is shown throughout our forecast. We have another 100,000 head, or slightly over that, I guess, coming out by the end of 2014. And this is really to drive that milk price up and put it at a more profitable level that will be required for the feed costs that we're really projecting. Now, the recent ramp up in cheese price and consequently past three in all milk prices has slowed the cow liquidation in dairy cow slaughter in the most recent weeks. However, it's expected to be short-lived. Cash prices have softened since then, and it hasn't really shown up in the wholesale prices yet, but we expect it to kind of temper out through the rest of the year and into 2013. As I said before, further reduction really is needed to get these producers to a profitable level. However, strong exports could definitely bolster prices and very much change this balance sheet. I have record high prices in the end of 2013 and the cow herd turning at about the same time. However, if we get stronger prices before then, we could see less liquidation and have a turnaround a little bit faster. Similarly, if we have an aggressive Farm Bill policy that really provides a strong safety net, that could also really affect the herd liquidation as well as where our price peaks really in the next couple of years. So moving on to hay, an important livestock feed for both for dairy cattle and cattle. We're now in the second year of record high prices, 2011 was largely driven by the drought in the southern plains. However, this year, the drought affected a much larger area, and consequently, we pushed hay prices to again be record high. Looking a little bit at the setup for this year, 2011 was the lowest hay acres harvested for at least the last 30 years, if not farther. And 2012 did rebound a little bit. Most of the acres coming back, we saw in other hay from the southern plains. They did get some of those acres back, but we only really gained about 3.5% in total hay acres. Now, acres were kind of the least of our concern this year. When we look at the large area impacted, yield was hit extremely hard. All hay yield declined about 10% nationally is what it's estimated to be at now. That's a significantly different situation than the previous year. Now, as a result of that, our production figure is going to be about down 7% this year, and prices have continued to climb basically where 2011 left off into this year, and will probably remain high for the rest of this year. Seasonally, we see a small uptick usually in the winter months. I don't expect a counter-seasonal move for sure, although how big of an upswing can producers really handle is going to be a big question. Overall, all hay is expected to be above $17 per ton above 2011's overall price. Other hay has actually seen the largest price increase this year. Alfalfa hay hasn't had such a large increase, but I think that largely has to do with dairy producers not being able to afford the high alfalfa prices of both last year and this year. One thing I also wanted to mention is hay trade has been an increasing sector for where our hay goes over the last 10 years. You can see it's steadily increased. Now, this is definitely more of an issue for the western states, and that's really become kind of where our hay goes in times of not just excess supply. You can see in 2011, high price points did not affect export markets the way they had maybe in disappearance domestically. We really haven't seen a price point where the export sales have slowed. 2011, I think, was up about 14% overall. 2012 is also expected to be higher. So far, year-to-date figures, January to September, alfalfa is about 10% above last year, and other hay is about 8.5%. Now, overall, the hay trade only represents about 2-3%. In the most recent years, much closer to 3%. And it's becoming a bigger and bigger deal, particularly for California, Oregon, Washington. Some of the hay drivers in the short term is going to be the winter weather. Last year we saw disappearance shrink considerably because of high prices, and that was due to a mild winter. This year we haven't had a lot of snow, at least in our part of the country, and that's going to really affect how much hay usage we use over this next winter and kind of prepare us where our ending stocks are going to end up for the following crop year. Also, the availability of substitutes. I know last year we fed a lot of corn stalks and different products to alleviate some of that price burden. It's going to, again, what's available, what's cheaper, what can we feed our animals. Now, in the long term, I don't expect hay to gain back a lot of acres just because other high-value crops are going to be competing for those acres too. However, what we are going to see, hopefully, is a more normal yield due to more normal weather patterns. But we'll have to see if the drought really alleviates that much. Export markets will continue to be a factor, probably a much larger factor. China has come into our hay markets in a big way. We don't know if that's something they're continuing to develop there or if they're going to continue to buy feedstuffs from here. Quarters have been hit or miss when they do buy. They buy a lot. When they don't, they drop off fairly quickly. And so that's going to be something that affects our market in a big way. looking at looking ahead, yields, as I said, more normal. Small bump in acres, probably similar to what we saw this year. But we're going to come into it with very tight stocks, tighter than last year, and that's going to really maintain high prices into the beginning of the next crop year. And if and until the next crop year is more certain, I don't see those prices shrinking back down to even 120. Right now we have them at close to 157. And as I said before, this year will be record highs, likely in the 190s to 200 range for all hay. So let's move on to corn. So I want to talk a little bit about prospective plantings. We really anticipated having a large crop this year, and I think as a consequence, producers didn't really buy a lot of feed ahead when so many of us were saying that we're going to have much lower prices, particularly as we started planting very early and we started planting a lot. Record high plantings were projected. This is a map from the prospective plantings report released by NAS, and you can see corn gained the most acres, second only to hay, actually, and that was an increase about 5.4% from the year before. Yield, of course, played a large role. Yields have been steadily on the steady pace upwards. We don't have too many years where we have a decline, but you can see what the effect the drought had. 122.3 bushels an acre has been the lowest since the 1995-1996 crop year, and you can see that's a dramatic decline from some of the previous years. As a result, prices skyrocketed as the summer developed, and that yield potential really fell off. I felt like every week we were lowering corn yields just based on the fact that we had no rain. When we talk about corn demand, we really talk about three major areas, which is like the ethanol and food feed category, exports, and then feed and residual. Ethanol is projected to cut back the least, less than 10%. And that means that most of the other sectors have to adjust. Now, this 2012 is pretty much an estimation, but you can see it's by far the smallest bar on this graph. Exports are probably forecast to drop the most. Unlike hay, our export sales have hit a price point where they do pull back from high prices here. They're down nearly 25% for 2012. Now, feed and residual is a very difficult number to forecast because there's no data to really estimate this number. It's basically what's left over from the other industries. Now this is down nearly, estimated to be down nearly 10%, and that's largely come from reductions so far in the cattle herd. Some in sows, and then in the most recent week, I do believe, poultry was down also. But just based on our balance sheet and where we need to be, this is going to be the sector that really reduces the most. We haven't seen exports really drop off as much as they did this year. So next year you'll likely see those bounce back. And so feed use is really going to be a particular area to watch in the coming months. All these demand factors, when we talk about adjusting to the really high prices that corn will set this year. Last year was a record high price. This year will for certain be a record high price. However, it's important to note that cash prices right now are encouraging producers to sell corn and not store it. And that would imply that where the futures prices are now probably need to go higher. Unless there's a lot more corn out there, we are going to need to see some further adjustments in probably the livestock sector and probably even exports possibly. Now in the short term, we talked about rationing the corn crop. It really depends on who's going to adjust. As I said before, I think it needs to be livestock. That's what the LMIC forecast largely reflects. Is reductions in these feed use categories. And in the longer term, corn is going to depend on what gets planted. So far, price is probably high enough that they're going to get similar acres to next year. Weather and yield will play a large role in where we go from there, but also the world supply. what is export demand doing? Where else are we producing corn, particularly in South America? And some of this too factors into the soybean question. We're hearing reports of South America having better crop. We've seen China kind of pull back on soybean shipments, and so that's kind of gone down. Corn will probably be able to get those acres based on how soybean prices are reacting at the current time. This is our corn balance sheet. Like I said, we have similar acres to last year. I would consider that about even. Hopefully we'll have more harvested acres, but that will really depend on weather and not a continuing drought situation. We do have yield being more normal, but definitely not record high. This isn't necessarily on the NAS long-term trend that they use, but it's pretty close. It'll be maybe just below. We'll continue to have tight stocks unless we have a fantastic year next year, but that will likely put our prices back in the mid-5. So with that, I think we're ready to take questions.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Caitlin. Yeah, we do have a few questions. Let me start off with one from the audience here. Where is this hay that you talked about being exported to?
So there are 5 export countries, basically, that over 90% of our hay goes to. China, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and then the UAE buy 95% of both alfalfa and other hay. And this is strictly talking compressed bales, not pellets. But those are the major 5.
Okay. You also mentioned that the farm bill was important to dairy profitability. Do you have any information or thoughts on the proposed dairy program's ability to impact milk supply and in turn the effects on milk prices?
I think that it'll really depend on when we kind of get it in place. I do think dairy will see some profitability breaks in the new crop year, particularly in hay, come hopefully May or June, and then maybe not first silage until much later in the year. So where the timing really is going to make the biggest difference. I think this, whatever safety net does go in place, will certainly help, but it'll help more if it goes in sooner rather than later, and that will maybe structure the liquidation a little bit differently.
Okay. Erica, have you seen any regional areas where the beef cow herd is growing, or do you see a region where the cow herd growth might occur earlier?
Well, we were expecting and seeing some herd expansion in the west and upper Midwestern areas when we look back at 2011. The drought of 2011 primarily impacted any herd growth in the Southern Plains area. So we did see some growth and some retention of heifers on the western side and the upper Midwest. And looking ahead, given that they were a little bit ahead of the game on a national basis and overall some of profitability indicators would suggest they may be in a better situation relative to other parts of the U.S. Look, if we do see any growth, it's probably first going to start showing up on the western region of the U.S. and that upper western, midwestern region, those northern plains, not the upper Midwest, the northern plains area. So probably the northern plains and the western regions is where we'll see any herd growth, heifer retention occurring more than likely first before we see it in other parts of the U.S.
Related to these heifers, that's certainly an important topic these days. What about placements of these heifers in the feedlots? Do you have any data on that and their impact on future beef production in general?
USDA NAS on a quarterly basis and the cattle on feed report does break down the number of steers, heifers, and cows on feed. And earlier this year, we did see large placements of heifers on feed. Now, I'm going to make a note. I mentioned in the presentation, too, this rate of change. Beef cow slaughter being down from a year ago, but you have to take it into respect relative to the January 1 inventory numbers. So taking that perspective, if you look at it, the 2012 calf crop is probably going to come down anywhere, say, 700,000 to 800,000 head from last year. So divide that by half. That's about anywhere from 350,000 to 400,000 heifers you have less to place to either retain or place on feed. So as we saw earlier this year, we did see rather large year-over-year increases in the number of heifers placed on feed. As we saw the year progress, that number has come down to about, we're about 1% above a year ago on heifers on feed. If those heifers do tend to exit for going into on a retaining basis, that shows up in other disappearance, and that's hard to gauge because we don't get other disappearance in terms of a breakdown of steer, heifer, cow. It's pretty much an eyeball estimate. So overall, we have the number of heifers on feed would indicate we are not retaining as many heifers as in prior years, that the number of the herd growth will be down. But again, this rate of change is key as we look at all these different numbers, from heifers on feed to heifers retained to the number of beef cows relative to slaughter and inventory. So we do get the numbers, and we use that as a gauge, but overall it would indicate that we're not putting a lot of heifers or taking a lot of heifers out, putting them back in the herd at this time, given the fact of the range conditions and the feedstuff prices and the losses to cow-calf profitability. And those losses on cow-calf profitability are very significant in those areas that had very severe drought and limited feed supplies relative to other areas.
Okay. And Caitlin, one last question for you. With this record price of corn being received by farmers, what impact do you see that having on the number of hay acres in years to come or next year?
I think it's going to be moderate. I didn't expect to see as many hay acres as we got this year with corn being so high, so I'd expect a similar situation next year. We're talking between 1 and 2%, maybe closer to 1. Particularly in alfalfa, we don't see that coming back as much as maybe it needs to for producers.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for to Eric and Caitlin for their presentation of from LMIC. LMIC is a really important partner for us here at Montana State, and so thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you again.
Okay, our second presentation this morning will be by Rachel Endicott. Rachel is the Extension Beef Cattle Specialist here at Montana State University. We stole her from the USDA ARS station out at Fort Keogh in eastern Montana. Rachel has her PhD from New Mexico State in range cattle nutrition. And with that, Rachel is going to be talking to us about feeding risks for drought-impacted feeds and forages. So with that, help me welcome Rachel Endicott. Rachel, you're on.
All right. Thank you, George, and thanks everybody for tuning in today. Appreciate the invitation to be on this webinar. We're going to switch topics away a little bit from economics, and we're going to talk about animal science. And so I figure, I hope I can keep everybody kind of on the same page that I am, but I figure that maybe I get confused by economics presentation, so I'm not going to feel too bad if I might confuse some of you with my animal science presentation. So today we're going to talk a little bit about overall forage quality in regard to drought, as well as the bulk of the presentation will be talking a little bit about nitrate toxicity and a small bit at the end about prussic acid poisoning, two main issues, at least from my perspective, that I've seen come across my desk is in regard to drought. Certainly overall quality, as far as drought impacted forages goes, is obviously the inhibition of growth leads to low or no quantity. In that regard, however, legume quality might increase as leaf growth decreases less than stem growth in a drought situation, but on the other hand, grass quality probably decreases because the stem to leaf ratio is increased. All right, we'll move into nitrate toxicity, a pretty hot topic. Well, so what is it and what plants accumulate it? Well, annual small grain crops or cereal forages such as wheat, barley, millet, and oats, as well as corn and sorghum and sedan grass families have been known to accumulate nitrate. In addition to crops that we might find desirable, weeds, such as this big long list here, which are common weeds in a lot of these production areas, also have the ability and the tendency to accumulate nitrate. So where do they accumulate that nitrate? Well, the highest concentration is going to be in the stem or the stalk, and especially the lower portion. For example, the lower third of a corn stalk will have the highest nitrates compared to the middle or the top third. Leaves have less nitrate, very often very little, and the grain generally has none. So here's a little ditty on plant nitrate metabolism. So nitrate uptake, though, is normal in a plant, And when we have normal conditions, nitrate is converted to nitrite, which is then converted to ammonia, which is used in protein synthesis for the plant to grow. However, drought conditions favor nitrate accumulation such that we might have an overaccumulation. The conversion to ammonia occurs in the leaves. So if the leaves are negatively impacted by drought, then nitrate will accumulate in the stem as we have discussed. So in the ruminant, that nitrate conversion pathway is exactly the same in the rumen as it is in plants. So say a cow consumes forage with high nitrate concentration, that conversion pathway from nitrite to ammonia is then overwhelmed, and so nitrite begins to accumulate. So we can get the first step in the process, but not the second step. The problem with nitrite is that that ion competes with oxygen for red blood cells. And nitrite, when it comes in contact with those red blood cells, converts hemoglobin to methemoglobin. And unfortunately, methemoglobin is then incapable of oxygen transport. So from a chronic standpoint, if animals are exposed to a moderate level of nitrate over a period of time, some symptoms that they might exhibit include reduced appetite, reduced milk production, rough hair or unthrifty appearance, weight loss or no weight gain, and abortion. Certainly a big concern for pregnant cows in a lot of this country with these kinds of forages. From an acute standpoint, a really hot sample, animal will have an accelerated pulse rate, labored breathing, muscle tremors, staggering gait with weakness, cyanosis where their mouth tissues will turn blue due to the lack of oxygen because nitrite has converted hemoglobin to methemoglobin, and eventual death. So we'll talk a little bit here about small grains and sorghum sedan, and then we'll talk about corn stalks. My recommendation is always to test suspect forages. In Montana, we have a nitrate quick test that the county agents have in their offices for testing forages. It's a colorimetric test, then follow that up with a lab analysis for an actual amount if you find that sample to be hot. If the concentrations are high, you have several options depending on how high they are. You can dilute that with other low nitrate forages. You can avoid feeding to more susceptible animals. So in other words, pregnant animals are going to be the ones we're going to try to avoid feeding this high nitrate feed to. So other animals might be more appropriate. And you know, if it's really hot and you can find a feedlot nearby who might have some steers they could feed it to in a small quantity, that would be a good thing. However, in the worst case scenario, that hay is probably going to need to be destroyed, and so you can have a really big marshmallow roast in that case. In thinking about corn and stalks and silage, the highest nitrate accumulation for corn and probably other plants as well occurs during heavy uptake. So if drought occurs during heavy nitrate uptake, then we're going to have a problem. So if drought happens during or immediately after pollination, then we have potential high nitrate. If drought occurs before pollination, we're probably more likely to be okay. A lot of folks maybe ensiled their drought-stressed corn this year. I know I've heard a lot of folks knew that their grain corn wasn't going to make, so a lot of people ensiled it. Nitrate actually dissipates during the fermentation of silage. And so with that in mind, producers should wait at least 3 weeks for fermentation to progress before they feed that high nitrate silage. Moisture is, of course, a concern, and a concern in drought, too, with how much moisture is in the corn. If recommendations suggest that if the corn is ensiled at less than 55% moisture, there will be less fermentation and then less nitrate breakdown. So that might need to consider testing that nitrate in the silage after you have it in the pit. As far as how the feeding value of that drought-stressed silage might be impacted, certainly we know that drought results in either no or only partial filling of the ear. So depending on the damage, generally drought stress silage is anywhere from 90 to 100% of the feeding value of normal silage. However, with this lack of fill of the ear, there's going to be a higher cob to grain ratio, which will indicate increased fiber and decreased energy. How about the shelled corn then? Well, generally drought stress shelled corn has anywhere from 92 to 100% of normal feeding value. We'll have a lower test weight. Depending on the market that you're in, market discounts for the low test weight may be greater than the decrease in feed value, which would be a bonus for someone feeding corn. In reference to corn stalks, cattle prefer grazing the leaves and husks, which are lower in nitrate, so that's a good thing. Drought stress stalks, though, might be stunted, and so then because of that, cattle will tend to eat lower on the stalk than they normally would because the nitrate will be higher. Drought-stressed corn stalks are also a concern in regard to the corners and edges of maybe some corn under a pivot. So producers also might leave cattle on stalks longer due to the feed shortage that we're experiencing, which forces the consumption farther down in the stalk where the nitrates are high. Some general suggestions for grazing drought-stressed corn stalks would be to not turn the cattle in hungry. If you're concerned about pivot corners and edges where the plants might be more severely stressed, you might want to fence those out. Really pay attention to how the cattle are consuming the stalks and pull them as soon as they've eaten most of the leaves and husk. And there is a product on the market that contains nitrate-utilizing bacteria. It's a bolus. And you can help the rumen adapt to those higher nitrates. Now, certainly this isn't going to cure nitrate toxicity, but is something that you can help the rumen adapt. So in regard to weeds, nitrate peaks at the pre-bud to the bud stages of the weed, and nitrate concentration decreases as weeds mature. So certainly I know that I did a quick little survey of our county agents and had some information in regard to how many samples they tested with their quick test. It ranges anywhere from 10 or 12 samples a year up to more than 200 samples a year. A lot of those are going to be small grain forages in our part of the world, so forage barley and forage wheat. All right, switching gears then to prussic acid poisoning. So we're going to talk about the sorghum and sedan families of forage more now. The way this one works is that drought-stressed plants in these forage families produce cyanogenic compounds. And once those compounds reach the rumen, they're converted to cyanide. So it's a cyanide poisoning. You might have read in the news there was some cattle in Texas who succumbed to prussic acid poisoning earlier in the year, caused quite a bit of a ruckus. Concentrations greater than 0.1% of the dry plant tissue are considered highly dangerous. So even a very small amount is going to be very worrisome. The symptoms can show within 5 minutes of consumption, and death can occur within 15. So symptoms we might see would be salivation, labored breathing, muscle tremors, incoordination, bloat, and convulsions, and in this case, the death is also from respiratory failure. Prussic acid poisoning might be associated with periods of rapid growth, maybe after rain or after irrigation on previously drought-stressed plants. I'm not sure that that was really an issue, because once we hit drought, we were in drought, but certainly something to consider. So in order to prevent prussic acid poisoning, you really wouldn't want to graze those drought-stressed sorghums unless they're tested for hydrocyanic acid. You'd want to graze the second growth sorghum with caution if the conditions are poor. And probably want to wait a couple of weeks after drought-ending moisture to graze. One thing about prussic acid poisoning in the sorghum sedan thing that's different than nitrate is when forages are harvested for hay, in the curing process, the prussic acid poisoning risk decreases because the cyanic acid decreases as the hay cures. However, there is no change in the amount of nitrate in a forage as it's cured for hay. So I really encourage those nitrate tests in those poor conditions to be done ahead of time before cutting. Then at times you can wait and hope that conditions will improve. So real quick here, we've discussed a little bit about overall forage quality, nitrate toxicity, and prussic acid poisoning, so probably the main feeding risks from my perspective for livestock, beef cattle in particular. So I would be happy to take questions if we have any.
Okay, thanks a lot, Rachel. We have a few questions for you. First one, when looking at hay, are there any visual clues that the hay will have high nitrates and needs to be tested?
No, there aren't any visual clues that the hay will have high nitrate. So in those drought conditions, certainly getting it tested is necessary. You can have some lovely looking, say, forage barley. That's just hotter than a pistol, so certainly not a visual cue, something that you need to have analyzed.
Okay. One from our audience. How much does the nitrate utilizing bacteria bolus cost?
You know, I am not sure about that. I would have to check. I haven't priced those, so I don't know that information.
Okay.
Bova Pro is the name of the one that I'm familiar with.
Okay. Thirdly, are there any feed additives that can be added to the ration to offset high nitrates?
So feed additives generally, other than the bolus that I described, probably not. So that nitrate's going to be converted to nitrite in the rumen. So knowing ahead of time and being sure to dilute that with other feeds is pretty critical.
Okay. Have you heard of any concentrated areas where high nitrates or prussic acid poisoning is at a really very high risk?
Okay. Areas I've seen and heard of high nitrate throughout the state of Montana this year. I'm less familiar with nitrate risks in other places. I do know that my colleagues at other universities, University of Nebraska, have been putting out quite a bit of information regarding the nitrate risk in grazing corn stalks. So I think that certainly throughout any of these drought-impacted areas, I think it's certainly something to take a look at.
Okay, a couple of other questions that came in from our audience here. Is prussic acid concentration related to frost?
I believe it can be. After frost, I think you have to wait a little bit to graze it, but you might, after a hard frost, be in better shape. But I'd be wanting to ask somebody in your area if you have forages with that risk.
Okay, and another question from our audience. For when cutting a grain hay, is there a time of day that can lessen the risk of nitrates?
Okay, sure. Nitrates tend to accumulate overnight in a plant because the leaves aren't photosynthesizing in the dark. And so throughout the day, so you can have a decrease in nitrate from morning to afternoon in grain hay. However, if it's a hot sample, often you won't be able to continue to, the drop in nitrate won't be adequate to take you out of the unsafe range over a day. So you might have to wait several days if you test it and it's hot. But certainly nitrate will decrease a certain amount from morning to afternoon.
Okay. Another question from our audience. How long will a bolus last in the rumen?
Well, they're slow release. So I think part of what the bolus does also is it provides those nitrate utilizing bacteria, and so if the cattle are grazing the high nitrate forage, then that provides for those bacteria a way to continue to reproduce. So you should be in pretty good shape if you have them exposed to the nitrate forage if you were to take them off and put them back on, you would probably need to re-bolus. But as long as you have an environment that's good for those bacteria to produce, you should be in fairly good shape.
Okay, and then one last question here that has to do with pasture, but what concerns are there when cattle are turned out on a very drought-impacted pasture following little moisture and then when the grass begins to grow?
Okay, well, certainly if we get some moisture and we go into, in Montana anyway, we go into spring and we get some spring moisture, grass tetany is a concern. If we have those cloudy days, that's going to be some calcium-magnesium imbalance as the plants are rapidly growing. So we might see more risk of that if we do get that moisture, especially on those pastures that might have been taken off pretty short. Often we can dilute the grass tetany risk as well with old dry forage that wouldn't have that issue. So we might want to keep an eye out for that. So a preventative method for that would be to feed high magnesium mineral going into that grass tetany risk time of year.
Okay, Rachel, thanks a lot. It's always good to have an animal production person on with these agricultural economists. So thank you very much for your presentation.
You bet.
Okay. Our final presentation today will be from one of the members of our Western Extension Committee. I always like to think about Jeff when we go to Western Extension meetings, that there's always one person that when he speaks up, everybody listens. Jeff is really that person, I think, within our Western Extension Committee group. Jeff is an agricultural and business management economist at Colorado State University Extension in the Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics. Jeff has actually been involved in some of this similar work to what we're doing today. He's suggesting his this is kind of where he cut his extension teeth, was helping farm and ranch families in Nebraska during the farm financial crisis in the 1980s. Jeff's currently a leader of CSU's Extension's Competitive and Sustainable Agricultural Systems Core Competency Area, and really one of the really outstanding people that we have in our Western Extension Committee. Jeff is going to be talking about should I buy hay or sell cows today? So with that, Jeff, you're on.
Well, thanks, George. Thanks for those kind words. You know, we've had drought in southeastern Colorado at least since prior to the drought of '02. So this picture that we see on the screen, that's my coffee mug out there in the blue and white cap, and it's really rather interesting. The decision that producers are facing right now is, do they buy supplemental feed, cull certain groups of the herd, do they cull the young cows, the old cows, whatever that may be, or simply just sell everything? And each option has dramatic production, financial, tax, even emotional impacts to that producer and that family. Well, Steve Koontz and I have been getting a number of questions, as have others, from producers and bankers. And to satisfy our own curiosities, you know, should I buy hay or sell cows? So we developed this little tool here that the producer goes in and enters, or banker can enter in information into any cell that has a yellow, pale yellow background with blue font, and then the results of all the calculations come out in the pale purple. Like any decision tool that we or any other land-grant university develops, it's a guide. The information and the results are very individualistic, so the producer needs to deal with his own. So let's spend a few minutes going through some of the results of how you might put in the information and what those results might look like in an example. Step one is really, what is the current year? And in this case, this example, we have a herd of 100 cows with a conception rate of 95%, weaning rate of 95%. So out of that 100 cows, we're going to get about 90 calves. Those steers will weigh 5.5, and while the heifers at weaning are going to weigh 515 pounds. Now, the right side of that may be the most difficult, in that many producers struggle with determining and calculating their annual cow cost. And we need that information. So what we do is you plug in this case, $595 a cow, annual cow cost in 2012, or that first year that you plug in the left-hand side. The next cell down is the one where you enter the non-feed portion of that 595. So in this case, 300, just about half of total cow cost are non-feed. And then finally, an annual percentage change in non-feed cost. How much are non-feed costs due to increase over the next 5 years? This is a real fun one, Eric and Jessica, or Caitlin and Erica have put together some great information for Outlook. Producers and others have multiple sources of Outlook. Here's the chance to plug that in. I put in an example of 5 to 5.5 weight steers. Those prices you can see. Heifers are assumed to be about 7 cents per pound less than the steers. Traditionally, this is what we see in Colorado. The next line is where you plug in the price of that feed supplement. Alfalfa hay is usually the easiest to find prices for, predictions. And the prices I have here are quite accurate for what we see in southeastern Colorado. You can see in 2013 a bump in price. Based on the meteorologist's forecast for snow in the Colorado mountains this year and the availability of irrigation water next spring, we're going to see lower production and thus higher prices. At the same time, what are cows going to do in that third row? And we're seeing $1,100 cows now. If the drought persists, as I'm reflecting there, in a drop in price, and then it goes up. This is a price that is crazy. As I listen to producers talk to them throughout the last couple of years, they're saying, you know, we're going to see $3,000 beef cows, $2,500. I brought that back down to what Steve and I and some of our colleagues are saying is more likely price for cows, depending on when herds across this country start to rebuild following drought. The bottom two rows are actually for the user to enter an amount of feed that he or she is going to feed those cows. You know, it's a total number of days, not necessarily consecutive days. So typically here, you will feed 120 days. If you move into the mountains, it's going to be higher. Those cows are going to normally eat 25 pounds a day. You can adjust the number of days and the pounds of feed to account for total pounds fed per year. And then we see the results. This is pretty straightforward. There's a couple of things that I would like to go into. Again, it lists the revenues, the expenses, pre-tax profits, and then some other information. As we go to the next slide, I have highlighted in the green box the salvage value of the cow. And this is simply that price that the user entered in a previous screen. The value of the cow kept in the herd is the salvage value plus pre-tax profits for all future years. So we've taken the profits or losses from future years and brought them back to the current year. If that value is higher than the market value of the cow, it would suggest that she is worth more to the owner to keep than to sell. If we drop down then, we have the speculative profit, and that's the difference between the salvage or the market value of the cow and the value of the cow kept in the herd. In this case, it suggests that the cow owner is actually paying $357 per cow in 2012 to have the opportunity to realize potential profits, whatever they might be. Further, the accumulative speculative profit results suggest that the producer would lose money keeping that cow. Cow owner does not recover within the five-year period the losses incurred during 2012 and 2013. The last line of the results shows what the cow is worth to the owner if kept throughout the year but sold at weaning in the fall of each specific year. Mathematically, it's simply the salvage value plus the cow or the calf profits in that year. The results of this example are quite similar to what Dr. Kuntz and I've explored, entering a plethora of input into this. The critical decision or conclusion is that a decision to keep cows this fall is really a long-term decision. The financial cost of keeping cows this fall and then selling those cows next fall is actually quite dire. You can see there it drops from, in the last line, $1,048 down to $239. Really, the only way to overcome the cost that producers bear in the first 2 years to get through this drought is to keep her for quite some time. I can't suggest strongly enough to people that they seek appropriate counsel before making the decision to buy or sell cows. Come January 1st, it's a little late to talk to your tax preparer about whether you should have sold cows in 2012 or not. There's going to be income tax and capital gains impacts with any decision you make. The decision may even alter one's ability to borrow money. Owners of rented pasture may not want you to graze the land next year, so you really need to talk to those people you rent pasture from. And if you're renting public land or sometimes even private land, that may not be available in the future if you don't run cows next year. So you really need to talk to all of the people involved, including your spouse and family. I've talked to a few producers coming out of the drought that said, I sold my cows, I'm never going to pull another calf again. When I come back, I'm going to come in back with yearlings. That is a family decision that he or she made. You can get the tool and the other information there from those resources at farmmanagement.org that we're at. The ruraltax.org is the website which all of us across the country writing income tax, capital gains, fact sheets. You can find that there, and of course my own website. I wish people luck in making these complex and difficult decisions that are made during drought. The emotional and financial struggles we each face are not to be envied. However, I can strongly believe that we will survive these tough times. We will have rain again. Thank you, George.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Jeff. We have a few questions for you here. First one from the audience. What discount rate is used when valuing the future returns in your model?
We did not use any discount rate on that. It's a very simplistic.
Okay.
The only discount value would come from the actual prices changed in there, but we did not account for use a discount rate.
Okay. All right. Good enough. Secondly, I think you kind of addressed this just in passing just a couple minutes ago, but is the buy hay sell cow tool available, and where is that available on your website?
It's on my website, but it's also on the farmmanagement.org website. And that will actually be put on the screen for the audience to download here in a bit. But it's at mine that I just gave.
Okay, so there's a couple different places that you can retrieve
right,
that.
Right, there's a couple of different places there that they can go to download that with all the other decision tools that we have.
Okay, super. That's great. Okay, we have three additional questions here. Do you have any decision aids or suggestions to help producers determine their cow costs?
We do. If you go to my website, and it'll take you to the decision tools that we have listed, and there's one that'll help producers walk through actually determining what their costs are. You plug in the amount of hay you would feed and the price and then vet bills, etc., and that'll be on there as well.
Okay, yeah, that'll be a valuable resource for utilizing this tool. Yeah, okay, good. Secondly, is the market value of cows in the decision aid a co-cow value or a breeding cow value?
The answer is yes. The user gets to put in whatever he thinks those cows will sell at. You know, during times of drought, we've seen breeding cows and cull cows being the same price. So I've played with, you know, it's not so much, George, the specific prices as the trend, how those are going to look and how high might those be. I would suggest you look at breeding cow prices because it would be more reflective of the potential to realize profits from the sale of calves.
Okay, good suggestion. Okay. All right, and one last question here. How does retaining heifers affect the analysis?
In this one, we do not take into, we call the breeding female a breeding female. So the cost would be of raising those replacement heifers would be in the annual cow cost. And that would, of course, as the herd, as an individual's herd changes in age, whether it's younger with having more replacement heifers or older, if you sell replacement heifers, younger animals, that would be a factor in that market value of those cows. We also have, at my website, there is a decision tool on whether to buy or raise replacement heifers.
Okay. So several valuable resources here for people that are working on this really critically important decision. In fact, we have several presentations that we're going to be doing up here in Montana in the near term. This will be some valuable information for them. With that, thanks a lot, Jeff, for your presentation. Thank you to everyone that participated with us in this webinar today. We have a few polling questions we need to have you complete here, and then we'll have a couple closing remarks, and we will be finished. But we'd like to have you hang on here and answer our polling questions as they come up. The first one, I think, has appeared. Prior to the seminar, how aware were you of the issues discussed today? And it looks like from the poll results that we had several people that were not so aware of the problem, this issue. See, the second one was, this webinar worth your time? Okay, and what is your greatest take-home point from today's seminar? And what's the likelihood of you participating in a future webinar with us. Okay, with that, I'd like to, on behalf of the AAEA Extension Section and our team within the Western Extension for this Ag and Uncertain Times, as well as our technical crew here at Montana State University, really appreciate everybody being on today. We do have some additional webinars coming up. The next one will be on December 7th, which will address tax and financial risk issues associated with drought and disasters. And then a third webinar, which will be later this spring, and the date to be announced, which will address strategies for the upcoming production year. So with those things in mind, we hope that you'll join us for one of our webinars coming up here in early, the next one in early December or later this spring. So with that, thanks a lot for being on board today. Have a good day.